What I've got assigned for the reading is the first chapter of my book, The Intellectual, which sets out kind of, you might say, in a way, it's a kind of mythical origin of the intellectual. We always, anything having to do with ideas in Western culture, we always trace it back to ancient Greece, and particularly to Athens, 400 BC, typically. And this is no different. And also, I have attached an article that was published in the journal Philosophy and Rhetoric a year or two ago called The Public Intellectual as Agent of Justice. And these themes are interconnected with what I want to talk about today, which has to do with the social role of the intellectual. Now, I think the first thing to keep in mind here when thinking about intellectual is that intellectual is concerned with ideas. And there are two general ways in which one might think about ideas. One is as something that are valuable in their own right, something that, you know, you want to contemplate. So when people are thinking about truth, right, whenever we talk about the goal of knowledge or the goal of science as being truth, right, in a sense, we're thinking about ideas as something that are the ends of our inquiry, things that we're going after, right? We're trying to get, like, the, you know, sort of the perfect vision of what reality is like, or what is the good, or what is the just, that kind of thing. And of course, academic philosophy and a lot of academic disciplines generally think about ideas sort of in that way. So people spend a lot of time in academic life refining concepts, for example, right? Trying to get clear about what one means, right? I mean, there's a lot of academic activity consists of that. And of course, those of you who are, you know, students, you're sort of subject to this as well, right? Because in a sense, that is part of what academic discipline is in a sense, part of it is clarifying what you're talking about. And so in a sense, trying to get at the ideas you're going after. So ideas in that sense are kind of treated as ends, right, as objects that you're going after. And in the ancient Greek context, somebody like Socrates, who is regarded as a very iconic figure in Western culture as the great man of reason and so forth, that's kind of how he thought about ideas too. Okay. But what I argue in the book and in this article is that, in fact, Socrates isn't really the person who is the origin of this social role of the intellectual. It's, in fact, his opponents. And so we get the other conception of ideas that I'm going to talk about now. And that one, in a way, has been, in a way, much more problematic, but also much more influential in the discussion of intellectuals. And that is the whole business of ideas as means, as techniques, as things that you use to get ends, to get action, to do something. Right, so the first one is ideas as ends, as objects of inquiry, pure ideas, you might say. And the second one is ideas as means, right, as techniques, as instruments by which you get something done in the world, typically of a practical nature. Okay, so these two concepts here that I'm juxtaposing, two different conceptions of ideas. And intellectuals have historically descended from the latter. And it's for that reason that there's always this kind of tension between being an intellectual and being an academic. Because an academic is interested in the ideas for their own sake, as ends, and the intellectual is interested in ideas as means to get things done. Okay? And I think the way you see that pretty easily in public life is think tanks. Right? What is a think tank? A think tank is precisely devoted to ideas in the second sense. Right? And when people like Gordon Brown have all these advisors around him trying to come up with clever ideas to win elections, that's kind of like what intellectuals do. They think about how ideas can influence what people do. All right. So that's, in a sense, where the role of the intellectual descends from, that kind of conception of thinking about ideas. Now, the people who are associated historically with this conception, the people who were the opponents of Socrates in the Athenian Forum back in 400 BC, were these guys called the Sophists. Now, you may know, in English language, sophist is a negative word. Right? When we say your arguments are sophistic, that means that you are smuggling some fallacies, you're trying to sell us a bad bill of goods, right? That you're telling us something we shouldn't believe, but you're trying to trick us in some way with your reasoning. Right? We call that sophistic. Okay? So in the history of all of this, right, the sophists have been tainted, right? So, and this word sophist versions of it appear in all languages in the Western world. So there's this image that the prophets are the tricky guys, they're the guys who, you know, you cannot trust, who when they say something you wonder, where's my wallet, right? They're not the pure pursuit of ideas people the way Socrates is. And that is a kind of stereotype dichotomy that has gone down for the last 2,500 years. Okay? And academics actually, when they talk disparagingly of intellectuals, they like to hark back to that image of the sophist. So for example, you know, I'm very much involved with a lot of these disputes that take place about evolution and creationism, and of course, one of the things I always have to encounter is people's opinions about Richard Dawkins. Okay, now Richard Dawkins, of course, is a professor at Oxford, but as I pointed out last week, he is a professor of public understanding of science. He is not a professor of zoology, even though he is has a kind of very blue blood, blue ribbon credentials in those areas. That is not what his professorship is in. It's in this kind of public understanding of science, which is kind of like a public relations job, essentially. And he's very upfront about it. Okay. Now, what do academics, even in biology, think about Richard Dawkins? Well, you get a very mixed reception. You get a lot of them who think that the man is too extreme, right? That in a sense, just to get headlines, just to aggravate religious people, he in fact overstates the case for evolution and for a very particular version of evolutionary theory, one that has the gene as being the dominant force in evolution. Okay? And so, why? Why do they think this? Right? Well, they think because Dawkins has got an agenda, right? He's got this agenda which, you know, is to kind of sell books, perhaps, to rid the world of religion, right? He's got all these things he's trying to do, and he's using the evolutionary ideas to kind of realize this. So, like, if you look at the book, The God Delusion, okay, at the end of the day, that book is trying to basically use science to leverage out religion from public life. And what's the role of evolution in the argument? Well, the evolution is just invoked insofar as it can be used against the religious people. So any potential compatibilities, let's say, between evolution and religion are downplayed totally. Okay? Now this is very much in the line of what, when one thinks about the sophistic character of the use of ideas, one thinks of this. Namely, where in a sense you're being very strategic in how you're presenting the argument, because you're really trying to win a practical point. And so you're only going to lay out the ideas insofar as they help your point, but you're going to leave out the stuff that doesn't. Okay? And, you know, this is very, you know, this whole way of operating, while it can become very tense in the academic world, you know, so if you have, you know, Richard Dawkins, it's not by accident that most of the audiences that Richard Dawkins speaks to are general public audiences rather than professional biological audiences. Okay, I mean, I think that's a very important point, right? That if he were actually trying to make these arguments in front of, you know, practicing biologists on the front line, they immediately start saying, look, you're overstating the case, you know, you're blurring crucial distinctions, right? I mean, this is really not on. Okay. Now, see, the reason why they give Dawkins slack, and I think this is an interesting aspect about the way in which academics and intellectuals relate to each other, is, of course, Dawkins never attacks science. He never attacks biologists. So as long as Dawkins is attacking all the people they hate, the scientists, then Dawkins is cool. Right? Let him go on. He's not attacking us, at least. He's attacking the guys we don't like. But that doesn't mean they necessarily would buy his arguments if they were presented to them as scientific arguments. Okay? That's a very important point. So this business of the social role of the intellectual is a very carefully crafted role in relation to other kinds of roles in the intellectual world. Okay? So, I mean, and this is quite an interesting kind of point because what happens, though, with the fact that Richard Dawkins has a lot of influence? So, like, you know, one of the things that you'll see in the course outline is I got a link to the top global public intellectuals. It's in Wikipedia. You can click onto it from the course outline. You'll see Dawkins is number three in the world. He's number one in Britain, number three in the world. Okay? So you might say, this is the guy who actually is the person. You know, anyone, you know, if an average person knows anything about biology, especially evolutionary biology, they probably know it from Richard Dawkins. Whether they like it or hate it, they probably know it from him, if they're not professional biologists. That's kind of what this point says, okay? And so then the question becomes, well, what's the impact of that? Does this have some kind of impact back on academic life? back on. You know, so for example, students being motivated. Like, you know, some, you know, you can imagine undergraduate students reading Richard Dawkins, getting very excited about what he's saying, and say, I'm going to become a biologist. Okay, so there's a sense in which that it's not quite as these two different roles for ideas, the academic's role of ideas as a kind of pure thing to be pursued in their own state, versus this kind of more strategic, instrumental use of ideas, they're not perfectly sealed off from each other, right? Because the guys who are working just in very particular academic realms don't have that much impact except on each other, right? And typically these people don't even get much public visibility at all until they win the Nobel Prize or something. And that's usually toward the end of their lives. You know, so they sort of go out in a blaze of glory, you might say. But people like Dawkins, whose first best-selling book, The Selfish Gene, was published when he was only 36 years old. And that was over 30 years ago now. Okay? That you know, this man has an enormous amount of influence on successive generations of people who potentially would go into science. Okay? So there's a, you know, there's a sense in which when scientists are kind of benign and neglecting what Dawkins is doing, they're not noticing that in the long term he may in fact have a lot more influence than they do over what biology is. Even though his views of biology are very exaggerated and strategic and all the rest of it, he may in fact have more influence. Okay, and that's an interesting point as well. So I think, you know, for those of you who think about moving into public intellectual life, you know, and you know, and typically what that means in practice nowadays is you go into public relations, you go into journalism, you become part of the think tank, you know, those kinds of things, rather than going into academia, it's very easy for people, and no doubt friends of yours in the university who decide to pursue graduate degrees, right, to say, oh, you're just slumming it, right? You know, you're just debasing yourself. You're just kind of going to be doing these, you know, kind of pushing these ideas around for all these politicians or business people or whatever. And that's just ephemeral, right? That's only going to last, you know, you might make some money off of it, but it has no impact at all. And if anything, it corrupts public discourse. You get a lot of academics kind of making this line, I mean, you know, against people going into public intellectual life. But the truth of the matter is, the public intellectuals often end up having longer term impact. And because they are directly impacting. Okay. And, you know, so for example, all of these students who are taking all of these advanced courses in biology, they're not just reading state-of-the-art stuff, they're also reading The Guardian or The Telegraph every day. They're doing both. Right? So not only are they getting influence from their teachers and from their textbooks, but they're getting influence from the public intellectual sphere by reading the newspapers, you know, or watching television or listening to the radio or something like that. And so public intellectual life does impact on even the academic culture in often very subtle kinds of ways. Okay? I'll give you an example of an interesting case. I mean, and I, no doubt I'm going to be referring to this a lot because it's something I'm always thinking about, and that is Darwinism. Okay? Now, Darwinism is no doubt the most dominant way of thinking about the nature of life. Evolution by natural selection, right? You've got to be a nut to disagree with it, right? So says Richard Dawkins. Okay. Well, in 2009, we're going to be the 200th anniversary of Darwin's birth and the 150th anniversary of Origin of Species. Okay? And this is going to be a big event. And people are now, I'm going to say, quite routinely these days, that Darwin is really the only intellectual figure from the 19th century who's still important. All the others went by the wayside. Marx, Freud, right? They're all gone. I mean, we're the only ones who are teaching the classical sociologists. Barely, you know? And so all those 19th century guys are gone. Okay? And it's just Darwin. He's still there. There he is. Right? He's still important. Okay? And then the question becomes, right, was this always the case? If you were charting the history, the intellectual history of Darwinism in terms of its prominence as a scientific theory, would it be, as it were, going from strength to strength? Would that 150-year history be going from strength to strength? And the answer is no. And that's an interesting point, okay? So Darwin publishes his books. Actually, he has a lot of popularity. Books are very popular. But they're particularly popular with liberal thinkers. That's to say, classical liberal thinkers, kind of free market type liberal thinkers, Herbert Spencer, people of that kind, liberal theologians, people like that. But there's a lot of skepticism within the scientific community itself. I mean, largely because it hadn't been proven that the Earth was as old as Darwin said it had to be for evolution to occur. That was still an open question back in the middle of the 19th century. But also because Darwin couldn't explain the mechanisms of heredity very well. You know, because, you know, at the end of the day, natural selection, you know, the environment hits the organism, and the organism's transmitting something to the next generation, but what is it it's transmitting? I had no clue about this in the late 19th century. You really have to go to the beginning of the 20th century to get this. So, there is a conference, a very famous conference, on the 50th anniversary of Origin of Species in 1909. Okay? And it's interesting to read the proceedings of this conference because most people are saying at this point that Darwinism is an ideology but not a scientific theory. And in fact, the way they talk about it is kind of the way people talk about, let's say, Freudianism today. Right? It gives you a lot of just-so stories. You can explain everything and nothing. There's no way of testing it. So this is before we get modern genetics. This is before the period that we start to get all of the fine-grained understanding of molecular biology and so forth, DNA, all the rest of it, that is now part of the guts of the Darwinian biological paradigm. This is before all that, right? But it's 50 years after Darwin's book is published. And people are saying it's just ideology, and it's only, you know, because it goes very well with the culture, which is very free market, and survival of the fittest, and high capitalism, and all that kind of stuff. That's the only reason why Darwinism still flourishes. This is the verdict in 1909. Scientifically, a dead letter, but politically, very powerful. So what you've got to imagine is in those first 50 years of Darwin's book, there's a lot of public intellectual activity surrounding it. A lot of writers, novelists, you know, journalists, politicians, business leaders, talking up Darwin. Meanwhile, the scientists are having their doubts. Okay? But the public intellectual side of Darwinism keeps it alive until you start to actually get some fine-grained understanding of the mechanisms of heredity. And at that point, then, you start to get the scientific community coming around to it. So what happens is the public intellectual side of Darwinism, the side of Darwinism you might say is ideology, actually keeps the ideas alive. Keeps them up there, right? So people can refer to them once some evidence starts to gain. Okay? And so then public intellectual life ends up playing a very important role in supplementing, right, the strictly academic scientific culture. Okay? Really, when does Darwinism really start to become sort of scientifically respectable in the sense that it starts to look like the kind of version of biology we have today? Well, it's in the 1940s and 1950s. That's when you really start to get the first textbooks that look like the kinds of textbooks you now use in biology. So, what are we talking about? 50 years ago? 60 years ago? That's about it. The rest of the time, Darwinism was either seen as primarily ideology or highly contested, controversial theory. Okay, so the point here is that public intellectual life can actually keep a lot of ideas in motion. That eventually the academics and the scientists will come around and say, well, maybe we can do something with this. Maybe there's something serious about this. Okay. And it's interesting because with regard to somebody like Richard Dawkins, who's this very big genetic reductionist, right? There is a revival of reductionism coming in now in biology, okay? And that's kind of interesting, and he seems to have been behind that. Among a younger generation of people, I mean, because of my involvement with the evolution creation thing, one of the things that I do is I read scientific articles and things like, you know, molecular biology, molecular evolution, you know, just to get a sense of where how these guys are arguing, what are the authorities that they're using in terms of making their larger theoretical claims. Because you can kind of trust these guys when it comes to the experiments and so forth. But then, of course, they always have a couple of paragraphs at the end of their articles. This is the technical scientific articles, where they give you the larger theoretical implications of what they're doing. And that's always the interesting part, right? What do they think they've proven by doing this computer simulation or this rather technical lab experiment? And I am very struck that in the recent literature in biology, more than ever before, among people who, let's say, would be my age, maybe even a little younger, Richard Dawkins is actually cited as an authority. His popular books are cited in these technical articles. I was very surprised to see this. Okay? And indeed, these articles are pushing kind of these extreme Dawkins positions in a kind of more technical, modest way. Now, that's interesting, you see, and that's an example of where this public intellectual stuff, because you can imagine a lot of these people who are writing these articles now in these technical biology journals, when they were students, they were reading Dawkins' Selfish Gene. And then, you know, as years go by, it's kind of brewing in their minds as they're doing the technical stuff, and then when they try to put it in some larger framework, they think, Dawkins, he's there. Makes sense at all. So don't write off Dawkins, and don't write off these people who I think academics would tend to see as vulgarizers. You know, this is this term, you probably run across it already, but it's... vulgarizer. This is how intellectuals are often described as this, right? This is when you call, when somebody popularizes something, but you want to give the implication that it's kind of nasty what they're doing, right? So not only are they popularizing it, they're debasing it in some way. So it's vulgarizing. And, vulgar just means, you know, the people from the Latin, okay? So when they the Vulgate versions of the Bible were the versions of the Bible that were published in the spoken languages of people, not in Latin. So this is where this term vulgar comes from, right? It's a crowd, right? A mess. And so the vulgarizers is this kind of negative term for intellectuals who popularize. But these people may end up having very important influence in the scientific and academic culture. Okay? So that's a... And no doubt we'll be coming back to this kind of example of Darwin. Because Darwinism, in a way, the Darwinism-creationism thing might be the most important academically inspired dispute in the public sphere today. You know, one where you can actually point to academic sources for where the arguments are coming from. Because a lot of the public disputes, in a sense, aren't that easily marked academically. But this one really clearly is. Okay. Now I want to say a little bit about the ancient Greeks and about Socrates and the Sophists and the nature of the kind of interaction they had. Because in a way so much of what we're talking about here when we talk about public intellectuals is about attitude toward ideas, okay? As you can tell by the English terms like vulgarizers, sophists, right, people who are public intellectuals are often accused of having kind of a bad attitude toward ideas, right? Attitude is bad, right? And this is definitely, if you read Plato's dialogues, which is where Socrates and the Sophists go toe-to-toe with each other, okay? You probably have, here's a reality check. How many of you have read at least one of Plato's dialogues? Okay, it's not bad. I was expecting much worse. When I was a student, no, never mind. Some of these dialogues, all of Plato's surviving writings are dialogues, okay? Plato is the first major philosopher. When you take a history of philosophy course and you're actually reading extant works, you are reading Plato in the beginning. And he kind of lays out a lot of the fundamental problems. What is the true? What is the good? What is the just? All this kind of stuff. What is the beautiful? And Socrates is Plato's mouthpiece, okay? And historically, Socrates was a teacher of Plato, but Socrates didn't write anything. And I'll say a little bit about that in a moment. But these dialogues that Plato wrote, a lot of them have the names of sophists. And so I'm just going to put a few of them down for you. Okay? These are probably the two most famous ones. Gorgias and Protagoras. Protagoras is the one who says, man is the measure of all things. And Socrates thinks that's horrendous. So these are two of the major sophists. And... here's the idea, right? When we're talking about Athens, and we're talking about 400 BC Athens, we are talking about a very powerful imperial city-state in Greece, which is basically a country just full of city-states, all of them trying to gain advantage throughout the Mediterranean and the Near East in various military incursions. In a way, it's kind of an age of imperialism, you might say, very much like the late 19th century in Europe, only it's kind of... instead of having the European nations being the imperial powers, you've got these Greek city-states being the imperial powers, competing against each other, trying to take bits and so forth. But the empires, but the areas that the Greeks are trying to take over are they're always quite powerful as well. Now, Athens was very distinctive because Athens was a very open society, and by the standards of the day, and really prided itself on that openness. Openness to all kinds of things. So, for example, it allowed a lot of foreign traders to live in the city. And this is where the Sophists come in, okay? Because the Sophists are almost to a man foreigners. They are traders, okay? They are traders. Socrates is a native. He's a citizen. All right? And Socrates, if you're a citizen in Athens, basically, you're a landowner, and typically that's a hereditary landowner. That is to say, you know, you descend from the people who founded the place. And you're typically somebody who's fought. You fought in one of these wars that the Athenians are always having because they go through their imperial expansion. So Socrates is exactly that kind of person. He's a kind of older guy. He's kind of living on a military pension. And because he's a citizen, basically he doesn't have to do anything for a living. Okay, the citizens are free people in a literal sense of not having to work. Now who does the work? Ah, well, you go back to these estates which are outside the city, and first of all, the people running it are women, the wives. They run the estates. And what they're doing is they're managing slaves. Now what are slaves? Well, slaves are these people captured in war. You know, so rather than putting them in Guantanamo Bay or something like that where they're not being very useful, right, what you do is you have them, you know, clean your kitchen, raise your kids, you know, that kind of thing, the sort of thing we have servants do these days. So it wasn't typically a hereditary thing. It wasn't like the way American slavery was, okay? But rather, it was something that you could actually buy yourself out of, okay? So, and Athens was just full of these people. And they were there in the estates, and they were doing all the work, and the women were managing them. But meanwhile, the guys, who were the free people in the city, they just spent their time arguing with each other. So what you've got in Athens, I mean, it doesn't sound so different from today, huh? But the thing is, so what you've got is the agora, which is this Greek word, a very interesting Greek word. In Greek, the Roman word is forum, and you know that one probably more readily. And what this word means, it means a space. It defines a space in the center of the city. What you are to imagine is something like the kind of stalls and the markets in a lot of the towns in this country, right? Which, in a way, are kind of multi-purpose venues. Right? So there'll be time when people will be setting up shop to sell goods, but then they'll take away all the goods and they'll have trials. And they'll have political rallies. Okay? So what the Agora defines in the first instance is a space within which all of these activities occur at different times. Alright? And this space is a kind of space of freedom. Freedom to buy, freedom to argue. Okay? And it's typically in the center of the city. And for the Athenians, this was kind of like the heart and soul of the city, right there. That's how you have to imagine this place. So these sophists, right, they're traders. But they're very distinctive kind of traders, because they are basically selling ideas or techniques to win arguments. Now you see, this is a very controversial move, because the Greeks, generally speaking, make a very sharp distinction between the mind and the body. They're very sharply distinguished in the Greek mind, especially in Plato's version of the Greeks. The body, you know, has to do with things like drudgery and housework and the things you need to do to live. But then when that's finished, that's all out of the way, then you've got the life of the mind. And the life of the mind is this pursuit of ideas for their own sake. Okay? And this is something that is open and available to anybody who is in a state of leisure. That's to say, you don't have to work anymore. And so the way I think you have to think about this, the way in which the Greeks imagined the intellectual life before the Sophists came to town, was very much like sports. Right? You know how, you know, if you're not working and you've got leisure, right, you've got to keep, you know, the body, you know, there's an aesthetic dimension, you might say, to yourself. You're not just an instrument for making things happen. But there's this kind of aesthetic way of relating to the world that involves your body, which sports and athletics is supposed to do. And the Greeks were really keen into that, right? The Olympics and all that kind of stuff. Well, intellectually, there's an intellectual version of that as well. And that's the spirit in which you do it. It's not something that, as it were, you take steroids for. It's not something that you think about very strategically, right? That you're going to do this to win some, you know, something that, you know, some practical end. You might want to win a prize, but not something practical like becoming head of state or something like that. Okay? And so, this is the way in which the Greeks naturally thought about ideas. Now, what this meant was, in terms of the sorts of things that you could buy or sell, the Greeks basically thought that it only things that were related to practical life, things that could improve your ability to get things done. So, for example, you know, somebody might be able to sell you a good pair of shoes or teach you how to be a good cobbler, and that's cool, okay? Because that's a way of alleviating your drudgery. And that's exactly the kind of thing that one should be able to pay good money for to get trained in and receive good products of. Okay? But what about winning arguments? See, this is what the sophists say. Sophists say, well, look, you know, in terms of things that alleviate, you know, our misery and ameliorate the human condition, there's also the intellectual side of this. We can think about ideas as instruments and means for attaining our own ends more efficiently. It's not all just about baking and making shoes and carpentry and stuff like that, shipbuilding, whatever, right? But it's also about winning arguments in the public square, and there are better and worse ways of doing it. And we can teach you how to do it. That's what the sophists were claiming. They know how to, because they know how reason works. They know how people think. They know how to second-guess people. They know what to say, when to say it, and who to say it to. And often these guys had very impressive results. They would say, X is my student. He is now, you know, a major politician in this country. Or sometimes these sophists themselves, remember the sophists are foreigners, so they themselves cannot actually be part of the government of the city, but sometimes they would make fiery speeches that would motivate people to do so. So, you know, there's all kinds of ways in which they can kind of demonstrate the power of what they've got to offer. Okay? And Socrates thinks that this is incredibly suspicious, incredibly destabilizing, okay, and completely undermining the integrity of Athenian society. Okay? So what he basically tries to do in the dialogues is, and this is something that you will see, this is the kind of move that gets made again and again in the history of philosophy. So Socrates is not, you know, he sets a kind of pattern here. Namely, that there is nothing to what the sophists are selling. In other words, there is no skill. There is no intellectual skill. You either have it or you don't. Socrates is one of these guys who basically believes that when you are dealing with ideas, you are communing with the gods. And that is not something you can buy or sell. Right? So he believes this whole search for truth and for knowledge is so pure, right, that basically you have to discipline yourself and have the proper kind of mindset to be able to do it. But it is not something that you can just sort of buy off the shelf. I mean, so you've got to imagine that these sophists, in a way, were a bit like, you know, management training seminars, right, where they tell you about, here's some examples of best practice, you know, and they say, look what happened in this case. Well, this is what you should do. This went awry. You shouldn't do this. You know, and so they try to teach you, you know, what works and what doesn't work. And Socrates said, this is debasing the currency of ideas. That there is no formula, there is no procedure, there is nothing of that kind. And the way he went about doing this, and again, Plato's student Aristotle pushed this line as well, was basically trying to show that all of these arguments and all of these alleged skills that the sophists said they had were in fact fallacious, right? They were false. In many cases, they did not lead to the outcomes claimed, right? And that, in fact, the sophists did not have any special kind of knowledge at all about how to think or how to reason. Okay. Now, you can say what you will about this. I mean, but it is interesting in terms of when when we justify things like going to war, for example, because this is a classic kind of thing where sophists would have some opinions about. You know, the President of the United States or the Prime Minister will basically give you a kind of, certain kind of view of the world, a sort of strategic view of the world. Look, in the world, you know, like, remember George Bush talked about the axis of evil, right? And so you get this kind of picture presented. You say, well, look, this is how the world is at the moment. These are how the people are moving, in which case we've got to do this, right? And it's being presented like this is knowledge. Right, George Bush, through his massive command of intelligence agencies and, you know, deep, you know, political thinking and all the rest of it, George Bush has got this worldview, and he says, on the basis of that, we've got to do this. Okay. Now, somebody like Socrates would come along and say, this is just bullshit. Who says the world's like this? Right? The only reason why people come to believe the world's like this is because they're all hyped up on the rhetoric. And this is the thing. Plato, when he does the dialogues, he uses a word. He coins a word, rhetoric, which is what Socrates says the sophists really have. Socrates says the sophists don't have wisdom, they don't have knowledge, they're just using rhetoric. And so what they're doing is they're basically engaged in some kind of con game, you know, getting people to sort of, in other words, you know, getting people to believe the arguments because in a sense they kind of like the arguments rather than because they're true. Okay? And this is a word, now the interesting thing about this word rhetoric, and classical scholars make a big deal about this, is that if you were to, you know, Plato isn't the only guy writing about this stuff in 400 BC. There are other people writing about the Sophists and Socrates too, so you actually do have alternative accounts. And the interesting thing about all these alternative accounts, these are not the accounts you would read in the philosophy course, but they're there, classics people read them, is that the Socrates and the Sophists were typically referred to as Sophists together. In other words, to everybody else watching, other than Socrates' student Plato, these guys look pretty similar. They were all called Sophists, including Socrates. That's an interesting point. But see, in Plato's dialogue, we get this word rhetoric invented, whereby Socrates distinguishes what the Sophists are doing, which is this tainted stuff, from what he's doing, which is this pure stuff. And this sticks. That's the interesting thing. It sticks because Plato's story sticks. And all these other guys writing about what's going on in Athens, they disappear. Okay? This is something about how, you know, part of one of the interesting things about knowledge, about the history of knowledge, I mean, this is why having a historical perspective is always valuable, is that, look, these disciplines just don't come out of the blue, right? I mean, a discipline like philosophy actually has to get constructed, socially constructed, and what that involves is figuring out what are the classic texts to kind of get the ball rolling. And, you know, putting Plato as the, you know, fountainhead of the discipline ends up anchoring a lot of what happens afterwards. Right? Because, you know, because we have Plato's view of what took place in Athens, we have this very strong distinction between what Socrates was doing and what the Sophists were doing, right? Where Socrates is talking about truth and the Sophists are talking about rhetoric. Okay? But it's only Plato who's doing this. It's just that we believe Plato. But all those other guys who were writing about this in Athens, they didn't see these differences so clearly. Now, of course, we don't know what the truth was, what was going on there, right? But the point is, these beliefs about what was going on turned out to be very important. Now, one aspect about the dispute between Socrates and the Sophists that was quite interesting, I think always I find it very interesting to talk about, is Socrates, as I mentioned, didn't write anything down. In fact, he hated writing. Okay? Now, we don't really think about the Sophists, right? But we think about, talk about the Sophists, and we talk about rhetoric and all that kind of stuff. I think our first image of it is as a kind of verbal art, right? People talking and persuading and that kind of thing. And, of course it is, but it's interesting that the Sophists were the ones who came up, especially Protagoras, came up with the idea that it's a good idea to write stuff down. Now, I should say something about writing, because, you know, the writing and speaking are two different media by which ideas get transmitted. I mean, this is perfectly obvious, but it's important to think about what the, you know, consequences are of ideas being transmitted in these two media. All right? Now, in the ancient world, if you, you know, and Socrates conjures this up in his discussions with the Sophists, you know, what does writing mean in the ancient world, in ancient Greece? Well, in the first instance, it means these big kind of news boards that in the Near Eastern empires, in Persia, Assyria, places like that, where declarations from the king, laws of Hammurabi, all this kind of stuff, that was writing. Writing was this very authoritative kind of thing, right? Laying down a law, you know, you're responsible for this, or telling people the news, like, you know, we've just done this, we are going to stop that. So it had this kind of very authoritative legal function, and it was non-negotiable, right? This was the thing that Socrates made a big point about, was that, you know, it's just there. There's no way to question it. It's just there. It's got this authority because of its solidity. It's just sitting there, and you say, well, must be the truth. Right? You can't interrogate that big slab of concrete with the Code of Hammurabi on it. And indeed, Socrates, in one of the dialogues, goes into a long digression about what he hates about the Egyptians, because they do a lot of writing too, as you know, hieroglyphics all over the place. And he says, this is just basically, you know, a culture that is basically inscribing itself for the dead. And there's a certain truth to that, right? The Egyptians are, you know, when we think about the origins of civilization, the Egyptians kind of lived right so that people after they came could see what they were about. And Socrates thought, this is ridiculous. This is not a way to live. So Socrates was very much against writing. He also thought, because one of the things the sophist said was, well, you know, if ordinary people knew how to write, so not just the scribes who were writing for the emperor, which is how it was in the Near East, but rather if ordinary people knew how to write, if any kind of, you know, educated person knew how to write, then they could actually write down their speeches before they go into the public square and might be able to make a more focused impact because they might actually know what they're talking about in advance and not just do it all on impulse. What an idea. What an idea. Okay? And Socrates wasn't going to happen. Because he thought that you write your speeches in advance, it's insincere. That you're not really speaking from the heart. And this is what he was always accusing the sophists of being two-faced and strategic and not, you know, and so you've got a script, basically, right? And so, you know, you've got your cue cards, your auto-cue, right? And that you're not really being yourself. And that you can't judge what people really think if they've written it out in advance. You've got to be able to judge them right on the spot. This is what David Cameron did so well last week. Remember that? Conservative Party conference, a man speaks for an hour without notes. I mean, it made all the headlines. It obliterated Labour's lead in the polls. And so much of it was just him coming out there talking. That's it. And it made headlines all over the world. Someone would do that. Okay. Well, this is kind of what Socrates is getting at, right? There's a sense in which, in terms of people speaking their mind, you are not really being trusted that you're speaking your mind if you've got cards lying around or autocues and things like this. Now, the sophists weren't very impressed by this argument. Though the argument did fly. I mean, Socrates' argument did fly in Athens. But the thing that the sophists emphasized, and I think this became very important as we start moving into the Roman period, this part of the sophist legacy was taken on, was the idea that if stuff is written down, people can be held accountable. Okay? Because so much of the argumentation, right, if you think about what kinds of arguments are going on in the public square, all right, of course there are arguments about what price to pay for goods. And there was some rudimentary writing was taken as given, so there was some primitive kind of accounting techniques used. But of course the other sort of activity that would go on in the public square would be court cases. People making accusations and judges having to listen. And you'd have a jury system in Athens typically, which would be randomly selected citizens. They'd be sitting there listening to people making arguments here, there, everywhere, and then they'd have to reach some kind of judgment. Now, in the day, you had to keep it all in your head. There was no, you know, it's not like today where, you know, where the jury can ask the court reporter to, you know, tell us what was said there at that point in the interrogation. No, that wasn't how it was. It's kind of like, you know, you would have to listen and make the judgment. That's kind of how it went. Okay? And actually, they elected their political leaders very much that way. That wasn't just the court cases. So, you know, Athenians have to argue about, well, looks like we're going to go to war. Who's going to be the general with the biggest ship? People start making arguments, blah, 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 blah. A lot of shouting, screaming in Athens. They were very loud people. Okay? And then all of a sudden somebody calls a vote. And then they just do it. It's a kind of voice vote. Right? You know, yay, nay, which is louder? Yays win. Okay, you got it. There's your vote. That's Athens. And I should say, if you're interested in that aspect of Athens, this kind of the way in which the movement of words and ideas got them to do all kinds of strange things over their history, because they were always reacting so spontaneously to things. You should read Thucydides, The History of the Peloponnesian War, with the big war that Athens had over many years with Sparta. Okay, and Athens lost eventually, got basically drained. And Thucydides, what he's recounting in this book is basically how the Athenians just went from one extreme to the other. They were just, you know, listening to the great speech, saying, yeah, we're going to do this. And then they said, no, we're going to do this. Okay. And there was just no sense of really serious deliberation. It was just being moved around by ideas. And one of the things that Thucydides suggests in the book is that both Socrates, you know, who as you know was put to death eventually by the city of Athens because they thought he was a total public nuisance. But they saw him as right, trying to make a living, and in fact providing skills that at least some of these Athenians thought was worthwhile. And here's this guy Socrates basically trying to undermine their business and causing general kind of instability in the society. Pass the headlock, please, right? This is the bottom line with Socrates. They eliminate him. But Thucydides says basically both Socrates and the sophists were kind of stirring things up, right? People, you know, arguments were being made, ideas were being tossed around, and there was really no space for serious deliberation. Everything was just happening on impulse. And that's kind of what led Athens to fall. Because Athens was this very wealthy place, very powerful place, very respected place, but just basically got into this kind of argumentative frenzy about what to do, going here and there, and everybody trying to be more clever than everybody else, and all kinds of deals being cut, all kinds of people undermining each other. It's very weird stuff going on. One of the long-term consequences of this is that the Romans, when they become the top dogs, they really put a clamp on the free flow of ideas. And those of you, if you're ever interested in studying the history of rhetoric, which history of rhetoric to a large extent in the early period is about kind of the conduct of political culture. How do people present themselves? I mean, as you may know, right, in Parliament, you watch Parliament on TV, and if you're American watching Parliament on TV, it's really amazing because it's just so, people just don't have any respect for anything, right? And it's very much, in a way, it's kind of a somewhat more dampened down version of what Athens was like. Okay? Except that there are constraints in the system, so like you're not going to take votes all of a sudden, you know, where the last guy's argument makes everybody go, yeah, you know, and then you get some new legislation in. No, it's not quite as bad as that. But there are, you can see how if you didn't have those kinds of constraints put in the system, like if you didn't have a Speaker of the House who can kind of tell people to shut up and so forth, if you didn't have those kinds of things, you would have something like Athens in this country. I mean, the way it stands, every week we're changing our policies anyway. No, so in a sense, we do have a little version, we have a little kind of dose of Athens in the parliamentary system. If you go to the United States, by contrast, the legislative process is incredibly dragged out, incredibly what we would say, deckers, right, where everything's formalized, right, takes forever to get anything passed. People negotiate everything, right, a lot of very formal, boring speeches. You ever see sometimes the congressmen are videoed and you get to hear them. Really, a lot of formality and bullshit, you know. But it's by slowing things down, okay, you don't get a lot of impulsive decisions made, except the executive power to go to war. Because executive power to go to war means the president can do this without Congress. So nothing slowed down there. And that's why people want to change that. But everything else in the United States is very slow. And this is a Roman thing. It's very much a Roman thing. And part of it is a reflection of the way in which people can be so easily swayed by ideas that they act in all kinds of, you know, erratic, contradictory ways over time. Right? So this raises a very interesting kind of question, which we're going to see in the course, about the power of ideas. Right? There might be a great need to discipline ideas, to not have them flow so freely, right? Academia and the scientific method are great examples of a certain kind of disciplining of ideas, right? Where in a sense you can't publish something unless you've demonstrated it with evidence and experiment and it's passed a peer review process. That definitely slows things down, okay? It's not like having to meet a deadline for a newspaper where you can get away with all kinds of stuff. So there's differences there. And in the political culture, having all of these rules of order, these parliamentary rules of order, all of these kinds of legislative procedures that are very complicated and legalistic. But nevertheless, what they do is they prevent any kind of impulsive reactions to ideas from occurring. So people actually have a lot of time to sort of think about stuff and not get too caught up in ideas. And so this, you know, this whole episode with the Greeks and the way it's kind of filtered into the political and academic culture underscores this point, which we'll see again and again, that ideas are powerful. They really can move people. And that maybe there needs to be some kind of constraints around them. Otherwise, you get into the situation that Athens was in that ended up leading it to be conquered by Sparta first, and then eventually Persia conquered all of them. Okay? So I'll end there. Remember, if you haven't yet provide your username. Send it to Elizabeth as soon as possible to get this Wikipedia thing going. Okay? See you next week.